Okay. Whew. My goodness. Trying to get back in the groove here. See if I can adjust my levels. Good evening. I'm Rick Moore, along with Tim Kearns, our ambassador of goodwill and super sports analyst, and, of course, our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky. Bill Newell getting ready for the Salem News Sports Writers podcast for tomorrow, and just trying to adjust the levels. We're back. It's been a long time trying to get our technical stuff squared away. And I don't know why that music is coming in so loud, but I think I know where there's another adjustment, and I can deal with that. Let's bring in Tim Kearns if I have him on the phone here. Tim, are you there?
I am here, Rick.
Hallelujah. Tim, it's been a long, hot summer. How you doing?
Surviving it, you know. we saw our electric bill double.
I don't even want to look at ours, man. I have no idea.
Oh, man.
Well, you know, but here's the thing. Here's the optimistic look at it. Gas prices tripled, so you're ahead of the game.
Yeah, but they're coming back down. You know, I mean, the gas companies, you know, good us, and they, you know, suck the life out of a lot of American families with the prices.
Yeah.
With the maybe a crisis out there, I don't know. But, you know, they got it up to a higher point. Now it's going back down, but it'll never get back down to where it was again.
Yeah.
So we as Americans, will get used to paying what we're going to be paying, and we'll just go on until it happens again. And then be shocked and blame who's ever sitting in the White House. You know, it's a crazy thing, but no one ever looks to the guys that are perpetrating it on Americans.
All right, let's we can save that for our political show and our sports our news show commentary. But Tim, great time of year for the kids and for most educators this time of year. I remember you know, for the 40 years or so that I taught, really getting anxious to get back in the saddle, as it were. But certainly for student athletes, this is a spectacular time of year.
Oh, it certainly is. You know, it's been a hot season for kids who played any kind of sports, baseball, you know, summer league lacrosse or other sports. Going to a camp had to be particularly distressing for them. But, you know, the coaching staffs take care of the kids. They provide a lot of water, a lot of breaks for the kids. So they do it right, looking out for the best interest. But, you know, it was a lot of fair weather. There weren't a lot of rainouts for sure.
Oh,
wow. I think, you know, teachers right now are like, you know, doing the slow cringe. I don't think it's a good time and an not-so-good time because they know either later this week or middle of next week they're heading back to the classrooms. And the kids will start to go, you'll see the slowdown, you know. The metabolism, the overall joy will begin to dissipate. But, you know, it's been a great summer. Haven't spent a lot of money on water or anything because they're all burnt.
Yeah.
It is a good time. Going back to school, going back to see classmates, maybe some kids you haven't seen all summer. And then in terms of the sports, it's getting back on the fields of competition, getting back with teammates, back with your coaches, getting back in shape. If maybe you took a few too many weeks off, but you know, it's always looking forward to the new season because, you know, hope springs eternal for everybody. Everybody starts out 0-0.
Well, I know when I was teaching this time of year, I was not ruining the end of summer. I was really looking forward to getting back into the classroom, and I always look forward to it, and it's a great time of year. We're going to be talking with John Parisi in a few minutes here. He's the director of athletics at Rockport High School, and I didn't realize this, Tim, but he said he had some pretty great scrimmages against your teams.
Oh, we always, you know, it was a game we always played once, if not twice in the in spring season. Johnny was always accommodating. He always managed to get his field ready probably 2.5 to 3 weeks before our fields were even ready. They did a lot of work. They had great community support. You know, the field, the grasses were cut, the infield was dragged. It was repaired if needed. And it was such a fun place to play at. You know, kids getting to go up and play halfway up the right field hill.
I hate right field out there.
And it had to be, you know, just a, an odd feeling, you know, to go out there and basically stand halfway up the hill, and you had to literally come down and in to get a short fly ball. Are you playing the base of the hill and taking chances going?
Well, I did that one time playing right field. I was a left fielder, but I was playing right field first time in Rockport, and I had no idea. So I started to turn around to run back, and I ended up slamming right into the hill instead of going up.
Oh, yeah, you know, it's kind of a remake of Duffy's Mound in the old Fenway Park, but probably three times as high.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Tim, we'll be talking with John in a few minutes. Maybe some thoughts on the sports attic, I guess, if you will. There's been so much going on this summer in so many different directions. What's the first thing that comes to your mind, maybe on the professional scene?
I think the Red Sox have been mildly disappointing to a lot of fans. The way they look going in, you know, everybody thought that they would contend, you know, for the division title. The Yankees got going early. They didn't stick this thing now, but they got, you know, they built a sizable lead. It's down to seven games now, but you know, if they can right the ship, they can run it out. The Red Sox never really got started. They, you know, the injury started, and they had, you know, bad start for the pitching and bad mop-up work from the bullpen. The guys you thought would be coming through with the bats really haven't come through in the bats. And the opportunistic hitting hasn't been there. Timely hitting hasn't been there. And so, you know, they've up and down.
Hey, let me interrupt you here for 1 second, Tim, because all of that is more than true. But one thing that really bugged me, and I really noticed that I've been watching most of the games, and I'm watching Xander Bogaerts' body language now, and I'm inferring this, of course, but he looks like he's really down.
He's not having the kind of season that he thought he would have. So I'm sure there's some internal frustration there. Then you add on the fact that the team, as a team, has not been playing well. They, you know, that the defensive struggles, I mean, are just embarrassing. Totally embarrassing. Fly balls missed, pop up missed, goofs in the infield. It's like, you know, they struggled to find a first baseman until Hosmer got here. So, you know, it's been disappointing all around, and you know, he's the captain, he's the leader, and he really needs to be, you're right, a bit more upbeat, a bit more positive. But I think it's getting to them. I'm sure they've been swirled inside about, you know, they need to make a change, and is he part of that change that they're looking to make?
Yeah, really. I don't know, man. It's just I don't know. And what disappoints me is, you know, we don't trash anybody. We never have. But it's very difficult to win in the major leagues when half of your lineup is either AAA or AA.
Yeah, you know, they run a lot of the younger guys through, and no one has really used it as an opportunity to break out.
Right.
And pitches have come up and really, you know, while they've shown a little bit, they haven't shown enough to stay upstairs.
Yeah.
And the pitching has been hurt, and getting them back online has been slow. So, you know, they're at 500 or just below 16-62. So, and they're last in the AL East. So, you know, Bill Postel said, you know, you are what you are.
You are what your record says you are. That's correct.
You know, you're not a good, overall, you're not a good team.
Yeah.
On paper, you know, Verdugo, Bogaerts, Devers, Martinez, Story when he's healthy. You traded a really good catcher, and now you got, you know, a young guy, and if you're going to be behind the plate.
I think the Vasquez trade really, really bothered some of the players, the way it was handled.
Oh, God, yeah.
You know, and that says a lot. But I still enjoy watching them. They've got some exciting electric players, but, you know, it's kind of a lost season. And I will say this. We got to take a break in about 1 minute here, Tim. I love watching Aaron Judge hit, but, man, he can't hit low and outside, can he?
Oh, that's where you got to pitch him. You know, you have to tempt him. You have to tempt him inside, and hopefully he doesn't turn on it. You know, mm-hmm. you gotta challenge, you don't go inside later, you gotta challenge him up above his letters so he can't get his hands up on it. Cause if he barrels anything up, it's just sheer power is gonna drive it out of the park. But yeah, you watch where you get him, you set him up high inside, and then you try to smoke it by him, low outside corner, you gotta go break, a lot of times you gotta go slider off that outside corner, so he's swinging over it. He's one hitter that you really have to be technically good.
Hey, what about Theak retiring? I think he's been one of the most enjoyable broadcasters I've ever listened to.
Yeah, you know, he used to drive me crazy with all the cheese.
I love it.
Nuts. And when Jerry got sick and he came on doing more, I kind of got used to it. But he doesn't overanalyze.
Right.
Now, the new guys, Euclid and a couple of the other guys, they just spend so much time talking, thinking that they have to talk.
Well, they're trying to find their way around, yeah.
Drives you nuts.
Yeah.
It's like, stop talking.
What I like about the act, look, first of all, he's a Hall of Famer. He's got his own lexicon, which I kind of like. I really like. But he has a way of criticizing mistakes or criticizing bad plays such that he's not disrespecting the player. And I think that takes a certain talent.
Well, you know, and you guys shouldn't be above criticism. You know, they should not be above criticism.
Exactly. And they're pros.
Exactly. And if you can't take it, get out of the kitchen.
And David Price is. He went to the West Coast. Okay. All right, Tim, look, we need to take a break. We'll come back with John Parisi. He's the director of athletics at Rockport High School and a former foe of Tim Kearns when Tim was coaching Gloucester High School. And then we'll be back with Gary Larrabee later on. And, of course, Mike Grenier. Can't wait to talk to both of those guys. It's been so long. So, again, this is MSO News Sports. I'm Rick Moore with Tim Kearns, our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky. Bill Newell working on the Salem News Sports Writers podcast for tomorrow. And we'll have more on that later on. We'll be back.
Hi folks, this is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. And if you're planning to replace the windows in your home, I have just two words for you. Anderson Windows. Anderson is the most trusted name in windows throughout the United States. See the complete line of Anderson Windows on display at Moynihan Lumber in Beverly, North Reading, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or visit us at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
The North Shore is listening to MSONewsSports.com and our great selection of podcasts.
Hi, this is Phil Stacey, Executive Sports Editor at the Salem News. Make sure to listen to our podcast every week with the sports writers from the Salem News, including Matt Williams, Nick Giannino, and myself.
MSO News Sports, connecting you to the North Shore.
With MSO News Sports, I'm Rick Moore. Now we're talking with Rockport Athletic Director John Parisi. John, it's been a while. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Rick. Yeah, good. How are you?
Excellent. Just great. You know, I think the good news is talking with Cape Bend League Athletic Directors last week and getting into this week is nobody's mentioning what's happened in the last couple of years. It's almost like back to normal. So I'm guessing that last year was probably a good year with respect to that for your student athletes, especially in the springtime. That had to be almost normal.
Yes, and I'm knocking on wood, as you say, all of that, just to make sure we're covered in the bases. Because
yeah, absolutely.
Previous to that, it was quite a nightmare. But yes, it feels like it's back to normal. The spring was normal. Yeah, so it's getting there. Yep.
All right, let's talk a little spring sports, John, because Rockport, if it's not the smallest school in the area, it certainly is among them. And yet, especially with baseball and softball and tennis in the springtime, your teams really competed very well.
Yeah, to be honest with you, we had an amazing spring, and it went a couple extra weeks longer than it has in past years, which we really, really like.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a whole bunch of new coaches at the helm. Kyle Nelson took over the baseball program, did an amazing job, and they qualified for the state tournament. Larry Burnham took over the girls' softball program, and they also qualified for the state tournament. Ted Twombly took over our boys' tennis program, and they went deep into the state tournament, losing to, I believe it was Weston, you know, Tennis Power, in the North semifinals. So, and then his wife, Stacy Twombly, coaches the girls' program, and they advanced as well in the tournament and ended up losing at Linfield. So, overall, great spring for us.
Yeah, and again, with the size of the school, it's amazing. I'm always amazed when you guys do so well, and I think especially of Dave Curley and boys soccer, you know, over the years. But let me ask you a personal question, John. What did it feel like not to coach baseball this year?
It was different. It was different. I don't feel like I had any extra time on my hands, so I don't know how that happened. It's just the day-to-day of this job allowed me to be places on the road. You know, I went to some road games, saw most of the home games and matches. Still went to a couple of baseball practices and chipped in a little bit. But overall, I think because Kyle did such an outstanding job, it made the transition a lot easier.
Oh, that's good. Let me ask you another question, too, about the size of the school and so on. If you're not offering a sport, and you can't possibly offer all the sports that some of the bigger schools do, do kids have an opportunity to go somewhere else, or how does that work?
Yes. We have a number of opportunities with our neighboring schools, starting with Manchester. We send our football players over to play football for Manchester.
Mm-hmm.
And in exchange, they send their hockey players to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we also send our boys and girls over to run cross country in the fall. So we go there for cross country. In the winter, our girls hockey plays for Gloucester. We swim with Gloucester, and we run indoor track with Gloucester.
So the kids really aren't missing anything, even if you're not offering a sport.
They're not. They're not missing a whole lot.
Excellent.
I think the one thing that we're not offering is lacrosse, and I think if we did, it would hurt our spring programs a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But we also go over to Gloucester and run outdoor track in the spring. So they're not missing a whole lot.
Excellent. Okay, listen, there's been some brush fires in the area. Has that affected the school fields at all?
No, that's the other side of town, about a half a mile from my house.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, so everything in the house smells like smoke. But
fortunately,
our fields have held up really well in the drought. We have wells up here, so we're able to water them. We don't have any turf fields here in Rockport yet. So the fields are looking good, and yeah, everything. Mary Ryan's out there, legendary coach Mary Ryan's out there practicing right now for the first time this fall.
That's incredible. I mean, tell me more about Mary Ryan. If there's anybody in the area who doesn't know about her, you got to hear about her. Tell me about Coach Ryan.
Oh, Coach Ryan's been around for 30 plus years. She is just such a good asset for our school. She was as a physical education teacher, and then she turned into the athletic director following another legend, Steve Rowell. And, you know, she stayed on as our girls' field hockey coach, which is amazing. And she battles numbers every single year because there's no feeder system for field hockey, unfortunately. And she just, the kids go out there and they play hard, they play the right way, they model her. She's such a great role model. Just a great person, and she's still actively involved with the Cape Ann League as like a secretary, and she's very actively involved with the MIAA. She's one of a kind.
Absolutely, and not every school has that. You have two people like that. Is Steve Rowell still involved?
Steve Rowell's Yeah, he's not directly involved currently, but he runs a bunch of preseason stuff for basketball.
Mm-hmm.
We've started a leadership academy that he's going to be involved with this year. Yeah, he's one of a kind. Dave Curley, same thing. You know, I said it not too long ago that that's Rockport Mount Rushmore with Raul, Curley, and Ryan.
Well, listen, John, how long have you been in the job now?
25 years, yeah.
Well, they may be carving a new face up there soon.
So. Oh, geez, that's so nice to say to me and those guys' company.
Oh, yeah, but, you know,
in my day.
I think the Rockport student-athletes and the league in general is so fortunate to have people like you guys. It's been amazing. And, you know, in fact, I was talking to someone recently about the old Manchester-Rockport basketball battles. I think it was back in the 60s, maybe, when they were fighting for a state championship, the two schools, and you know, baseball. You get legendary baseball players all over the place. It's amazing to have such great athletes come from such a small town.
It really is, and we have such a nice little rivalry with Manchester Essex, and we have for a long time because mm-hmm. we're so similar in size. You know, obviously, when they took on Essex, Essex left Hamilton Wenham, and they went to Manchester. That hurt a little bit. They really have a significant athletic program over there, considering their size.
Yeah, but I also remember when Essex left Gloucester, and that was distressing to me as a teacher. And I was living in Essex at the time, and to see the Essex kids move over to Hamilton when I'm, it hurt. So I know what you're saying.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, let's talk about spring sports now. You got underway, I believe, probably with golf on Friday, but today's really the start of it all. So tell me what's going on.
Yeah, so today we actually delayed golf until today. So Coach Larry Burnham is coming off back-to-back Cal Champs.
Mm-hmm.
He graduated quite a few seniors, but he's got a good group coming back, so they should be able to compete and qualify again. Yeah, so they start this afternoon at like 1 o'clock. Mary Ryan, like I said, is already underway outside right now. And then our boys' soccer will come in this afternoon for practice, and they're under second-year coach Jason Roussakis. I pronounced that wrong probably, but following David Curley after 30-something years is never easy, but he did a really great job for us last year, and we expect good things from our boys' soccer program again. And then girls' soccer, they kick off tonight at 6 o'clock under coach Greg Twombly, who's probably in his fourth year, and they had a nice run last year in the state tournament as well. They qualified for the first time in history. So yeah, we're looking forward to a great fall. We have great numbers considering
mm-hmm.
almost 50% of our population plays sports in the fall. So it's incredible.
That is amazing, and that's great. That's almost like a private school thing where you have to play a sport, so that's really cool. John, is there a message that you give to your coaches at the beginning of the year in terms of just getting ready for sports in general after coming off the summer, or is it just just nuts and bolts scheduling and that kind of stuff?
No. I stress up and down that communication is just so important. I said explaining kids' roles to them, not at the beginning of the year, but weekly, bi-weekly, just making sure kids know what their roles are on the team, how they can change the role, how they can get better, be more of an impact player, or just get a little bit more playing time. I just stress that up and down all the time with our coaching staff, and they receive it, they hear it. And they do a nice job. We have very, very few, and again, I'm knocking on wood, parental complaints about playing time.
Well, I
think they know their role.
That was my next question. I was going to ask you about your message to the parents.
It's very, very similar. I just say to the parents, they should expect to hear from the coach often. If they don't hear from the coach often, they should approach the coach and ask them what their role is on the team and how they can change that role if they're not comfortable or happy with that role.
Well, I know that we had Tim Kearns was baseball coach at Gloucester High for a long time, and we were both teachers, and a lot of times kids would come up and complain about the coach, I'm not playing, and so on, and the message from Tim that I echoed is, okay, then you have to play better. you have to let the coach know that you're better, and if you're not, if someone's better than you, you got to expect to support that.
It's that simple. Yeah, I had a number of great scrimmage games against him when he was coaching baseball over there, and his teams were always prepared. But yeah, you got to work harder. You got to get better. Do whatever it takes, and your playing time will change. It's in your hands. It's in nobody else's.
All right, I want to ask you an anecdote about that from your baseball coaching career, and then I'll let you go. In over the course of your career, and I don't need any names or anything, but can you remember a time or two when it was exactly that situation? Maybe a kid was a freshman or a sophomore. He thought he was better than he was, complained, blah, 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 or was just a bench rider. And then all of a sudden, maybe as a junior or a senior, everything kind of clicked, and the kid got to play a lot for you. You remember situations like that and what it feels like for both you and the kid?
Very, very few and far between. And again, just not patting myself on the back, but the communication part was the strength.
Mm-hmm.
But my final season, I had a student, a senior, who was not at all happy with his playing time, and I walked up behind him in the hall one day, and I heard him bad-mouthing me.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, so I just brought him in, and I addressed it. I said, you know, so-and-so, your fielding is suspect currently.
Mm-hmm.
Your base running is suspect currently. You can definitely hit at this level. Let's fix it. And he started every single game after game six that year, right into the state tournament as a DH. And he was an impactful player that year that we lost in the North Finals.
That's a great story. Now, that's what I'm talking about. That's really cool. But on the other hand, it's also cool that you didn't have to do that often when the kids were able to get the message and participate. John, anything else you want to mention about the upcoming fall season at Rockport High School?
No, I'm just hoping for a great season here. You know, it's huge for small schools to embrace the sports programs and show a lot of support and pride in their athletics. And I get that from the administration here. So, just looking forward to a great fall with a great coaching staff and great kids.
One final question: what's the longest road trip you guys have to take?
Normally it's Amesbury or Pentucket.
Mm-hmm. How far is that? Like an hour drive from Rockport?
Yeah, on a school bus, it's about an hour. Yep.
Okay, all right. Hey, John, thank you so much. I wish you all the best this season, and I'll be in touch with you later on in the fall.
That sounds great, Rick. Thanks again for having me and all you do for our student athletes.
You're very kind, Coach, and right back at you. Thanks a lot. Take care.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That is John Parisi, who is the athletic director at Rockport High School with MSO News Sports. I'm Rick Moore. Okay, and we return now with Gary Larrabee, who is a sports historian and golf writer, and it's been way too long. Oh, and I want to point out that Gary is heard right here on MSO News Sports. Also, on the weekends, starting Friday around 1 o'clock, you can hear him on North Shore Sports Desk with Nick and Nick, Dominic Nicastro and Nick Kukuru. And, of course, those programs run all weekend. They also have the Merrimack Valley Sports Desk here on MSO. They've migrated from the defunct WBOQ, and we're so happy to have them here. And Gary Larrabee, of course, is the golf expert. With Tim Kearns, I'm Rick Moore. Gary, welcome back.
Great to be back with you, Rick, and so pleased that we are back up and running.
Amen to that. Amen to that. Gary, so much to talk about, and I'm sure Tim has prepared for this, but I read the passing of Tom Weisskopf, and I remember him back in the 60s and 70s as a classy dude. He had a quote that just sticks in my head as one of the great sports quotes of all time. And he was talking about Jack Nicklaus, and he said, you knew he was going to beat you, he knew he was going to beat you, and he knew that you knew he was going to beat you. And I think that's, as a second-place finisher, that's one of the classiest lines of all time.
Yeah, and, you know, Tom followed Jack Nicklaus to Ohio State, and people thought that maybe Tom would be another Jack Nicklaus, and of course he was not. However, he was still a great champion. He won 16 PGA Tour events. He won the Open Championship one year over in Scotland, and had a terrific career as a golf course architect. I did have the good fortune, guys, to meet Tom once. I was out at Ohio State as a student, and I was also the first student manager that Ohio State's golf program ever had, believe it or not.
Wow, okay.
And Tom was out there in the late 1968, the fall of 68. Tom was in the reserves. He was vulnerable to the draft because it was the Vietnam War era. And lo and behold, one afternoon I was out there with the golf team, and they go out on the golf course, and I was just putting around, and who shows up on the nearby practice range but Tom Weisskopf to hit some balls on one of his days off from working in the reserves, serving in the reserves, and he sure loved my Boston accent, but beyond that, he knew I wasn't much of a golfer, so he didn't take me out on the golf course, but we had a nice brief encounter. And I was always a fan of Tom Weisskopf's after that, and they always claimed he was an underachiever. But nonetheless, he had a great, great dresser, great smile, great air about him on the golf course, and 16 tour championships and one major championship. Ain't too bad, Tom.
Nice story. Tim.
Tim.
The thing I remember most about him was the way he always carried himself. But yeah, you mentioned his style of dress. Those plaid pants on a Sunday were just really sometimes over the top. He was ahead of himself as a dresser. I think he may have inspired Payne Stewart.
Maybe. I love the way he walked, too. And he just carried himself, because he's also famous for making a 13 on the par 3 12th hole at Augusta National one year.
Oh, jeez.
Who of us hasn't done? Come on.
Yeah, he also finished four times at the Masters.
And,
but had a great career, married twice, had a great second career as an architect. He beat Nicklaus. People may forget this. He beat Nicklaus in two playoffs, one for a senior open and one, I forget the other event on the regular tour. But he beat Nicklaus twice in head-to-head confrontations, which wasn't too bad either. And we'll miss him, but he was a great part of the PGA Tour story for many years and in the golf community, and he will be missed.
Yeah, he was. You know, he was part of that, like, I would say, like, the great second tier of golfers during that time period. You know, you had Tom Kite, the ultimate second-place finisher all those years. You know, made a lot of money finishing in second.
So true. And, you know, there were so many good players in those days. You know, we forget about them, and there are so many more good players today. However, I think in that era, going back to the 60s and 70s, I think there were more outstanding players than there are today, although there are an awful lot of good players out there today, and we'll obviously see what happens when the LIV Tour comes to the International in Bolton on Labor Day weekend. That's in 2 weeks, really. And, of course, Tim, you've probably been following with the PGA Tour Players Group. Had a meeting the other day in Wilmington, Delaware. Tiger was there, which means it was huge news. And the word broke out today, guys, that the PGA Tour may be restructuring its schedule a little bit and designating 15 to be tournaments they want virtually all the top players to play in. We'll see how all that shakes down between now and later this year with PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan. But
so does that mean they'll undo pensions of all the guys that have gone to the LIV in order to get them back?
I don't think they're going to get any of those guys back. And I think there's word out there. There's seven more players who will be leaving for the LIV Tour once they finish up the Tour Championship playoffs, the FedEx Cup playoffs, this week down in Atlanta. So the worm still continues to turn in that situation.
You know, Gary, I was thinking about it last week, and I wanted to talk to you about it. You know, this is very similar to the American Football League coming in 1960, the World Hockey Association coming in 73, that took away a lot of the Boston Bruins, a big office of big money, only lasted a few years. And those guys made their way back into the NFL. Is the LIV Tour just an example, again, a lot of people are saying, of just the capitalist society we live in with competition arising and guys making choices of where they want to go to make their money?
That's a tough question, Tim. I really can't answer it because I think there's going to eventually be some type of a compromise met amongst the PGA Tour, the European Tour, and the LIV Tour, at some point down the road. There's never been so much money on the European Tour or the PGA Tour, and of course the PGA Tour is adding more and more money to the pot by the week or so, it seems, to try to keep as many players as they can from leaving to go. Of course, we know how much Live Tour has most of the money that's made in the world these days, it seems. So it's going to have to wait and see, I think, Tom, Tim, and how this all shakes down, but we'll have some kind of an idea maybe by the end of the year, maybe not to the end of next year, since they're expanding their tournament schedule from 8 events to 14, and they're going to supposedly get some more players after this week's FedEx Cup playoffs wrap up.
Gary, I was remiss in sending the agenda to Tim. I did it just now, so he hasn't had a chance to look at it, but you've got some really good information about local golfers?
Well, lots to just talk about briefly and just make note of the fact that we had the Emmerich brothers, Aiden and Christian. Aiden played in his second USGA Junior Championship, made it to match play, lost his first, won one match and lost the second. Christian did not win a match, but he also played in his second U.S. Amateur last week. Did not make it to match play, but Chris Francoeur from Amesbury did, was getting ready to try to go to Corn Ferry Qualifying School. Chris was leading after the first round with five other guys at 68. Didn't play so well the second round, but he got in a match play, won a match, and then lost in the second round. But great showing by those three guys. And, of course, speaking of the Corn Ferry Tour, Rob Oppenheim finished a tie for 50th, not very good, in the first week of the three-week Corn Ferry playoffs this past weekend in Boise, Idaho. This
I looked that up because I'm trying to see where he finished. How bad does he feel? He finished 12 under par after four consecutive subpar rounds and finishes 50th.
Well, it just tells you how good the golf is out there on the Corn Ferry Tour. And you got to shoot low numbers. Simple as that, Tim. Wherever you are, you have to shoot low numbers. Oppenheim has a second crack at it this week in Columbus, Ohio, at the same Ohio State Scholar Course. That was where I met Tom Weisskopf, coincidentally. And then the following week, they play in Newburgh, Indiana. These are all million-dollar events, lots of money to be won. But Rob has a tall order to try to make it to the finish, the top 25, after these three events only, which would give him a chance to get back on the PGA Tour. At the age of 42... the window of opportunity is very quickly closing for Rob, and all we can is hope for the best this week and next week, and we'll keep talking about him, hopefully.
Yeah. You know, it's, like you said, doesn't get any easier as you get older, but he's pounding it out there, trying to make it.
Well, we'll see how it goes. You talk about a very unique story that should be showing up in my column this week in the Salem News. Last couple of weeks, we've had two interesting local club invitational four-ball tournaments. One was in Tedesco, where Greg Mahan won his second Tedesco invitation four-ball in 3 years and his third in 4 years, which has never been done before. Believe it or not, guys, amongst the four major four-ball tournaments we have here on the North Shore, which includes Essex, Salem, and Myopia.
Mm-hmm.
Over at Essex, guys, we just had a team win led by captain by Greg Seward. Actually, not Greg. Greg, it's Greg Mahan. This is Craig Seward, S-E-W-A-R-D, who's a great, great, great grandson, by the way, guys, of that Thomas Seward, who was the Secretary of State.
I thought that name sounded familiar. That's incredible. Wow.
For Lincoln and Johnson back in the mid-18s. Anyway.
Oh, my goodness.
Craig's a good player. He's been trying to win the Essex four ball for over 30 years. He finally won it recently with his college roommate from Lake Forest College out in Illinois, Lee Ross, R-O-S-S. They've been trying for over 30 years, guys, to win the Essex Four Ball. They finally did it. They're both in their 60s. They beat a couple of 60-year-olds in the final match, a couple of two-time winners of the Essex Four Ball, Carrie Rich And I'm thinking, and Ted Ober, O-B-E-R. So a great story to see, though, about one guy has been in complete control of Zanesco four ball the last 4 years, winning with two different partners, I should note. And the most recent last two titles were with Mr. Abruzzese from Kernwood Country Club. Playing four ball golf, guys, is so hard. It's 2 minute against 2 minutes match play. You got to win five or six matches. And these guys have done it two different ways, but congratulations to both of them and their partners. It's a fascinating dynamic and all part of the golf experience.
All right, Gary, let's finish it up here with the LPGA.
Well, yeah, it was interesting past weekend, and I'm sure Tim saw it, that Nelly Korda overcame a seven-shot deficit and beat her sister, Jessica, at the LPGA Tour's tournament over in Spain last week, and very unique to see siblings beat each other on the tour. Tim, you may remember one other pair of siblings who were pretty good players among the men's side way, way back. J.A. Bear and Lionel A. Bear from Louisiana.
Oh. Yeah.
We're talking late 50s, early 60s. They both won a PGA championship. So I think these are the most prominent and most talented sibling rivalry we have on any of the tours right now. It goes back to the A-Bears, we're talking 60 years ago. And lastly, guys, I'm sure, Tim, you saw that Patrick Cantlay won the second of the three weekend FedEx Cup playoffs, the BMW Championship in Delaware yesterday. He won the same tournament last year on the way to winning the FedEx Cup playoffs and the $18 million first prize. Let's see if he can do it this coming weekend again down in Atlanta.
Yeah, should be an interesting take. Again, when FedEx comes around, everybody sort of perks up and pays a little bit more attention.
Well, there's a lot more good players not playing because they're over in the LIV Tour now. You know, Dustin Johnson, Patrick Reed, Brooks Koepka. A lot of good players are no longer competing in this thing, so it's a little bit easier to win, but we'll see what happens this weekend.
Okay, and your column will be in the Salem News this week.
Hold up, Gary. What about the Patrick Reed lawsuit, the defamation lawsuit?
Yeah, against Brandel Chamblee of the Golf Channel. Well, Patrick Reed has a pretty shaky past. I don't think that's going to go very far. He doesn't have much credibility when it comes to legal action in the golf world. But I don't think that's going to go anywhere.
Okay, I didn't think so either.
All right, Gary, great to have you back. Great to be back talking with this stuff, and look forward to hearing from you on the North Shore Sports Desk this weekend, and we'll check in with you next Monday.
Look forward to it, guys. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Gary. Take care and be well. All right, that's Gary Larrabee, who is a sports historian and, of course, golf writer. And we're going to take a quick break and come back with Mike Grenier, also a sports journalist, talk a little basketball here in the middle of the summertime. You're listening to MSO News Sports. This is North Shore Sports Night. I'm Rick Moore, along with Tim Kearns, our producer and engineer, Phil Proposky. Bill Newell teeing up North Shore, actually the Salem News sports writers for tomorrow.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. And if you're planning to replace the windows in your home, I have just two words for you. Anderson Windows. Anderson is the most trusted name in windows throughout the United States. See the complete line of Anderson Windows on display at Moynihan Lumber in Beverly, North Reading, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or visit us at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
The North Shore is listening to MSONewsSports.com and our great selection of podcasts.
Hi, this is Phil Stacey, executive sports editor at the Salem News. Make sure to listen to our podcast every week with the sports writers from the Salem News, including Matt Williams, Nick Giannino, and myself.
MSO News Sports, connecting you to the North Shore.
All right, we're back now with Mike Grenier, a sports journalist. Having a little problem with one of these things that are going around. Mike, how are you feeling?
I am feeling somewhat better, you know, but I wouldn't wish the shingles on anybody in this country, I don't think, you know?
No, no, no. I know several friends of mine, and I fortunately got my second shingles shot recently, and keeping my fingers crossed. Tim, have you had all your vaccinations?
I did. I actually got a mild case of shingles 2-3 years ago, and I got the shot, and I've been good since.
Oh, boy. Well, Mike, jeepers, I hope you get better real fast. You know, I know it's been a long siege for you.
Yeah.
I want to start, you know, I want to get to the Kevin Durant saga. But first, this summer, one of the things I've been doing when I get sick of the Red Sox losing 28-3, I will flip over to YouTube and I will just Google Bobby Orr or Ted Williams or Bill Russell. Well, not Google, but YouTube. And I punched in Larry Bird the other night.
Yes.
And I cannot believe how the national media, much of the national media, across the spectrum, including terrific basketball players from all ages, consider Larry Bird almost unanimously to be the best clutch shooter of all time. I even have a video on our website right below this broadcast.
That
questions him as the GOAT. Of course, you know, that's Bill Russell. But there was one sportscaster.
You mean it's not LeBron James?
No, no. There's one sportscaster, I couldn't believe it. He said, he comes on and he says, well, Larry Bird is my second favorite. And then he said later on, he said, well, wait a minute, let me amend that. He's 1B. Michael Jordan is 1A. Larry Bird is 1B. But the consensus is his clutch shooting ability. And I wonder, I know you saw Larry Bird a lot, and maybe you could comment on his rather unique talents.
Right. And you know what? You're right about the clutch shooting. I think that one guy who feared it the most was Pat Riley. As an opposing coach, he would admit after games that he didn't want the ball going anywhere near Larry Bird. Against his teams, you know, against his Lakers teams, mm-hmm. Against his Miami teams when he became sort of the president of the team. He feared Larry Bird without ever having to step on the court against him as a player. He feared Larry Bird more than any, I think, coach or general manager that I've ever come across. And there were plenty of people who feared Larry Bird in the clutch. The ability of Larry Bird in his clutch shooting has to do, I think, obviously with his confidence. He was fearless in every situation, but he was even more confident in game-winning, game-changing situations. And by clutch shot, Rick, sometimes we don't necessarily mean the game-winning shot. It could be the shot that puts them ahead by two after they've been down 10. You know, he's just the guy who did it continually, from the day he stepped on the court in 1979, 1980, right to the end. He wanted the ball in those situations. He demanded the ball. He just didn't want the ball. He demanded the ball. And his teammates were more than happy to give it to him because he was just so good in those situations. He feared no defender, of course. It didn't matter that
there's the one story where, I don't know, it was KC called the timeout and dropped up this play. And he finishes, and Larry goes, "Just give me the ball."
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He did that a lot. I used to see it in the timeouts, Tim. You're right about that. He used to sort of be on the outskirts of the timeout, and no matter what Casey Jones or Bill Fitch was saying, and Bill Fitch was his coach in the early years, he really had such a phenomenal, self-assertive way about him in clutch situations. He lived for that big stage, right, Tim and Rick? He lived for that big stage, and he delivered much more often than he didn't. It was a surprise when he missed a clutch shot.
Yeah, there's all kind of videos on Larry Bird on YouTube, and there's one where a bunch of former NBA players talk about playing against Larry and how tough it was. And they all said, you know, he was one of the biggest trash talkers. But he would come down and he would tell you exactly what he was going to do.
Right.
And then go out and do it, and there was nothing you could do to stop him.
Right, right. I mean, he was he was so fundamentally sound that he trusted his instincts to go with his confidence, of course. And he had a great shooting touch. Tim, what would have happened to him if he didn't bend his finger so badly in that stupid softball game that he played, or baseball game, where, you know, his right index finger was bent out of shape? Would he have been an even better shooter? Because you got to figure that was an injury that stayed with him his entire career, and he adjusted so well that he still became a great shooter in the NBA. But he had a misshapen finger his entire career.
Didn't he do that in a fight outside of a bar?
No. I mean, of course, there was. Yeah, he's gotten a couple of brawls, but no, he got hurt in a baseball game or a softball game. I well remember it. I think there's, of course, all kinds of talk and all that stuff. And he was in a brawl, but I think the original injury came in a baseball / softball game.
I think the thing that cracked me up watching the video were so many African American great superstar athletes were kept. They intimated. I thought Larry Bird was black because he played.
Right.
So and when you watch him, he's not as poetic or as smooth as other guys are, but damn, he gets the job done.
Right, and you know, it's so funny. I guess he kind of reminds me, on the basketball level, of Tom Brady, because when you look at Tom Brady,
right,
seven championships, six with the Patriots, you look at it, how incredibly slow he is, and you say, how could that guy have ever good enough to win six Patriots championships and one with the Tampa Bay Bucks? Larry Bird was pretty slow, but he still played very solid defense. He was above-average rebounder, and, of course, all those moves he had on offense. And it's a great pass. Let's not forget, guys, and Rick, we talked about his clutch shooting, and Tim, you can address this too, his passing ability. His passing ability was unsurpassed, I think. You know, he was just the best passer, along with maybe like Bob Cousy and a couple of guys that we've seen over the years. Certainly from a big man standpoint, from a forward standpoint, he was definitely, I think, the best passer I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On the 86 Celtics, one of the Boston writers said, on that 86 team, you had the best passing big man of all time, Bill Walton, and you had the best Bob Bryant. He said he had the best passing forward of all time on the same team.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how much destruction could two men run?
And guys who could catch the ball, too.
You see the highlight film, and it's like over-the-shoulder passes, line passes. It's like just super ridiculous that they were so in tune with each other.
And this is why, like, guys like Robert Parrish and Kevin McHale in particular loved Bird for that. He made Parrish's job so much easier because Parrish could score inside and outside. He had that nice little jumper even from the from the foul line and further back. And Bird, it wasn't just a matter of passing the right time. He would also put it in a position where McHale just had to up and shoot it, or Robert Parrish had he put it in the perfect place in their hands. And the part of their body where they would catch it and shoot it real quickly. So that's another side of his passing ability. It wasn't just getting him the ball. It was getting him the ball at the right precise moment, and at the precise angle that would lead to a basket for either McHale or Parrish. Those two guys in particular really benefited from Larry Bird's extraordinary passing game.
All right. I hope people take a look at the video we have posted up here. But let's change directions here as we're winding down time. And let's get updated with the Kevin Durant talk. And I haven't talked to Tim about this. I've talked with you about it, Mike. I don't want Kevin Durant. I want the team as it is.
No, you know, it's so funny because a guy I know from the Boston Globe very well, Chris Gasper, wrote a column.
Oh, I like Chris, yep.
Great guy, great kid. And he wrote that the Celtics shouldn't pursue Kevin Durant. But I was thinking, and I love Chris, what planet has he been on for the last 8 weeks? Because everyone else has been saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
They do not want any part of Kevin Durant, especially when we found out that the Nets were asking for both Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown for Kevin Durant. That's a completely preposterous mode or method that the Nets, if they want to try to acquire a Celtics guy, maybe Jaylen Brown. I don't think the Celtics would ever give up Tatum for him. It would have to be a Jaylen Brown package. But I really don't think Brad Stevens was in a serious, any kind of serious discussion with them about giving up that type of caliber of talent mm-hmm. for Kevin Durant, who is going to be 34 years old when the season starts, and who has been become in the last few years sort of a chemistry breaker. You know, he demands certain things for every team he goes to now. He wants general managers to change. He wants management to change. He feels like he's the CEO of the team that he's playing for, and he can make all these changes. And 3 months later, he changes his mind. So to me, Kevin Durant has had his best days. Still a great player. I'm not knocking him as a player, but his attitude has slowly eroded over the years. I don't know, Tim, do you agree with that?
Oh, totally. I don't want anyone to stay in North Station. You know, like I want to jump real quick. I saw an article 2-3 weeks ago that amongst NBA executives, many of them feel that the Celtics have made the biggest move of any team in the NBA in terms of their roster acquisitions.
Yes,
and they. Yeah. In many people's eyes, there's a favorite next year.
You know what? And Rick, I'd love to hear your comment on that. I think Brad Stevens, of course, his philosophy is so different from Danny Ainge. Ainge used to love to pick up all those draft picks and store them away like potato chips or something like that to be used for the day. And Brad Stevens' philosophy has been, like Tim just alluded to, adding to the current roster, not with young guys who you're uncertain about their ability or their ability to play in clutch games, but he's added veteran guys who've been through it all. That's why you bring along a Malcolm Brogdon and you bring along a Danilo Gallinari to add to a core that's already a very good. And you know what, Tim? They just picked up Denzel Valentine as a guy who could fit at the end of the bench, and he's like a 6-year veteran. He was a first round pick of the Chicago Bulls 6 years ago. He played 5 years with the Bulls. He averaged 10 points a game one of those seasons. He's been plagued by injuries the last couple of years, but he's only like 27, 28 years old. And he's a guy that could play that role like a Grant Williams, a seventh or eighth man, or a Peyton Pritchard, or, you know, one of those guys who comes off the bench and gives you 8, 10, 12 points on a given night. And to me, that's another good Brad Stevens move. I mean, this kid's Valentine's going to have to bake the roster first, but he's an NBA-worthy player. He's definitely a veteran that the Celtics might be able to use to add to that bench strength. And obviously their core lineup, their starting lineup, is already very strong as long as Robert Williams stays healthy.
Well, what I like... Go ahead, Tim.
I'm looking through the Celtics roster on ESPN, and my question is, how does Derek White fit into the future of the team
right.
at almost $17 million a year?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I still have mixed feelings. I don't know how you guys feel about White, but I have mixed feelings about him because he came over here with a lot of acclaim. He played for Greg Popovich and all, but he had a very up-and-down playoff series. You know, he had some shooting woes. He had some troubles at the foul line. He's pretty solid on defense, so I still think it remains to be seen how the fact that he will be off the bench coming, but at least he's going to have a full training camp this time, and to see how he fits into the system and playing with Coach Udoka for the first time for a full season, he might fit in more seamlessly this year than he did a year ago coming later in the season. So it still needs to be worked out, but I'm holding out hope that he's the player that the San Antonio Spurs fans thought he was.
I love his energy, and I agree with you. I want to give him another chance because he can light it up, man. He gets out there, and boy, everything just picks up.
Yeah, but as far as Grant, go ahead, Tim.
Brogdon is another point guard, and going to be making $22.5 million. You know, can you afford to have a guy making 17 sitting on the bench?
Well, I think he'll only sit on the bench for, you know, like 7 or 8 minutes in the first quarter, and then he'll be in there. I think salaries almost have nothing to do with
it. Yeah, I don't care about that,
I mean, you know, everybody makes humongous money. I mean, there are guys who average 6 or 7 points a game who make $20-25 million a year. So it comes down to how useful you are. If the Celtics are willing to pay that so-called threshold, reach the tax threshold, and they have to pay extra money, pay tax on all of it because of the salary cap, they're willing to do that. I think that what Brad Stevens has done, Tim and Rick, is try to build a complete roster, 1 through 10, that will be useful from game 1 through game 82 of the regular season, and then for a long playoff stretch.
I want to finish up, Mike, as we wind it down here, on that thought, because it seems to me that Brad Stevens has recognized where his strength lies.
Right.
At first it was with the young kids, but it kind of fizzled out. And he sort of, I think he understood he reached his max potential as a coach.
Yep.
But his vision as a coach was, he was able to transform that into, his general manager, whatever the title is, to put together what you just said, 1 through 10, sort of like a college perspective where everybody's interchangeable. Not that that's the case, but he has this vision, and it seems to me that that's a form of humility, if I'm reading it right, that you don't see too often among the greats. And I think that he has the potential to be a great front office guy.
Well, I'll tell you what, these offseason moves, as Tim alluded to, getting Brogdon and Gallinari in particular to add to the bench strength. And by the way, we also found out over the weekend that Jason Tatum played in the playoffs with a broken wrist.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He was hit late in the season, and it was kind of like a... It wasn't like an incredibly serious, but it still was a broken wrist. It was like a sort of a displaced. It wasn't displaced, but it was just short of that.
Mm-hmm.
So he was definitely affected. He said in the Milwaukee series, Giannis came down hard on him as he was making a layup, and he jammed that wrist by accident. Giannis did, and Tatum said he felt an incredible amount of pain. And he played through that pain and through the wrist injury. He wasn't trying to make excuses. He just sort of mentioned it over the weekend at an event that he was at.
Yeah, he didn't make excuses. He also got that shoulder banged up, too.
Oh, yeah, he definitely got the shoulder banged up. I really think that affected his shooting. He never, ever mentioned that it affected his shooting.
Mm-hmm.
But I really feel that was in the Miami series, I believe. And I really felt that affected him in the finals. And plus, he played a lot of minutes, guys. As we both know, I think he might have led the NBA in playoff minutes. So... I think that's why adding to the roster this year will hopefully take a little bit of the heat, not just on Tatum, but also on Jaylen Brown. I don't think they should feel that they need to play 36, 37 minutes a game to win a game. And it also, obviously, this added depth and strength on the bench helps a guy named Al Horford quite a bit.
Yeah.
He's going to be 36 years old, and is coming off a tremendous season, as we know.
All right, Tim, let's wrap it up. We got to go.
I agree with everything what Mike said, and Horford coming back, I think is going to add a lot of stability to the team too. I think a lot of the younger guys are going to understand just what he did last year for them, and just his senior citizen presence of sorts will certainly add. And I'm really glad to hear that the NBA was going to retire Bill Russell's number across the league, much the same as Jackie Robinson's.
Right, and you know what? I think it's phenomenal, and Rick, I'm sure you do too, but of course, none other than LeBron James wears number 6, and I'll bet you he probably feels, when he retires, that they would have made that gesture for him.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, let's save that for another day. Mike, great to be back with you.
Right.
Get better fast, and we'll talk again next Monday.
Yeah, we'll hope that the Celtics can avoid the shingles all season.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks so much, Mike.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Take
now.
Care. Tim, I got to run. It's been great. We will see you next Monday.
Very good, Mr. Moore. Talk to you then.
Thank you, Coach. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, bye.
All right. That's Tim Kearns, of course, Mike Grenier, and I'm Rick Moore. This is MSONewsSports.com. Thank you for being with us.